From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Your drinks here.
The new film Leaving Las Vegas stars Nicolas Cage as an alcoholic who goes to Las Vegas to end his life in a final binge. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the film's director and screenwriter, Mike Figgis. The movie is based on the semi-autobiographical novel by John O'Brien. While the film was in the pre-production stage, O'Brien committed suicide. Also today, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new albums of R&B by D'Angelo and R. Kelly. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Clinton says the peacekeeping effort in Bosnia cannot erase the horrors of the war there, but he says the NATO alliance can prevent further suffering and help the people of Bosnia rebuild.
For peace to endure, the people of Bosnia must receive the tangible benefits of peace. They must have the food, the medicine, the shelter, the clothing so many have been denied for so long. Roads must be repaired, the schools and hospitals rebuilt, the factories and shops refurbished and reopened.
The president was speaking at a meeting with several Bosnian refugees at the White House. The president's plan to send 20,000 U.S. troops to take part in the NATO peacekeeping force won the backing of former President George Bush today. From Houston, Bush called on both houses of Congress to pass resolutions supporting the mission. The French government has announced that it's upgrading its relationship with NATO as the alliance embarks upon its largest military deployment ever. France pulled out of NATO's military command nearly three decades ago. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Foreign Minister Hervé de Charette said France was coming back into the structures of NATO. He said the country would take up a seat on the military committee and participate in defense ministers' meetings. Since 1966, France has only been a formal member of the political wing of NATO. Sat in on informal military meetings. De Charette indicated that France wants to play a greater role in military planning for the operation in Bosnia. The country is contributing 10,000 troops to the NATO deployment, and they'll be stationed in key sectors in and around Sarajevo. U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher welcomed the French move, saying it's especially significant now as the alliance prepares for its largest operation ever. France is putting its troops in Bosnia under NATO command. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Budget negotiations are resuming in Washington today. House Speaker Newt Gingrich said both sides should take the December 15th deadline seriously and not even think about extending the time for agreeing on a plan to eliminate the federal deficit. Gingrich says the U.S. soldiers headed for Bosnia aren't getting any extensions.
No one is asking our young men and women leaving for Bosnia. Would you like to go in January? It's like to stay home in Germany and be with your family. We're saying you have to serve your country when your country calls you. And the president and the members of the Congress ought to settle down right now, get the budget balanced, passed now, and do our job now. And we ought to stay as long as it takes to do our job for the American people now.
Gingrich made his comments during a speech to the American Medical Association in Washington. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 35.5 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Government forces raised the Sri Lankan flag over the former Tamil rebel stronghold of Jaffna City today, marking the end of the rebels' de facto government for about a million Tamils. But the fall of Jaffna is unlikely to end the civil war in Sri Lanka. With the Tamil Tigers now dislodged from their urban base, fighting is expected to increase in the jungle areas controlled by the rebels. Former South Korean President No Tae-woo was indicted today in a massive corruption scandal that has involved many of the country's leading businessmen. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Seoul.
Former President No Tae-woo is charged with amassing a political slush fund from big business totaling $650 million. Prosecutors have applied to seize all of Ngo's assets, including his home. The list of indicted industrialists who made the illegal contributions reads like a who's who of South Korean business leaders and include the chairman of the Samsung and Daewoo conglomerates, two of Korea's largest. The corruption scandal coincides with the start of another sensitive investigation, a probe into the 1979 coup d'etat. The combination of cases has set the stage for a high-stakes political drama that has provided a temporary boost to President Kim Il-sung, who ordered the probes. Today's indictments represent Kim's latest efforts to sever ties with the past military regimes. In Seoul, this is Julie McCarthy.
Some key House Republicans have proposed a compromise to bridge the differences between House and Senate versions of legislation to deal with pornography sent by computer. The proposal would soften a provision in the Senate telecommunications bill that would impose prison sentences and fines on anyone found to make indecent material available to children. That measure has been criticized by online computer service providers. The compromise would give the online companies a defense as long as they make a good faith effort to keep pornography out of the hands of children. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Mike Figgis directed the new film Leaving Las Vegas. This moody film stars Nicolas Cage as a failing screenwriter who's been drinking away his career, his friends, and his money. After alienating everyone he knows, he goes to Las Vegas, where he intends to drink himself to death. There he meets a prostitute, played by Elizabeth Shue.
So Ben, with an N, brings you to Las Vegas. Business convention?
No. I came here to drink myself to death. Cashed in all my money, paid my Amex card. I'm gonna sell the car tomorrow.
So, how long is it gonna take for you to drink yourself to death?
I think about 4 weeks. I don't know for sure, but I think I got enough for about $250 to $300 a day.
That should do it. What am I? A luxury?
Yes. You're a luxury, and your meter just ran out.
Although these two characters fall in love, Ben has no intention of letting that interfere with his plan. Mike Figgis, the director of Leaving Las Vegas, also directed the films Stormy Monday and Internal Affairs. Leaving Las Vegas was made on a modest budget. Figgis wrote the screenplay for Leaving Las Vegas and based it on a semi-autobiographical novel by John O'Brien, who committed suicide while the film was in pre-production. O'Brien's father said the novel was the suicide note. I asked Figgis how similar John O'Brien's story was to the one in Leaving Las Vegas.
Well, in the sense that any really great writer will transmit his own psychology and his own soul into a story. And that probably, one could argue, is something that separates great writing from just technically good writing, is either the presence or the absence of the artist's soul in the work. And if I certainly think that his soul was in this. And if you take away some of the details, like, you know, the character Ben dies of drink in Las Vegas and meets a prostitute, I don't think that John O'Brien actually went to Las Vegas and lived with a prostitute, because he was, you know, at that time a very happily married man. But I do think, and having met his family, that the details and the observations, and also talking to other ex-alcoholics, and they all say, you know, it's chilling how accurate his observations are, that I think John O'Brien is completely in this story.
Did John O'Brien intentionally set out to drink himself to death, like the main character does in Leaving Las Vegas?
Well, in an article I read, it's quite interesting, in the last month, I've learned more about John. I mean, I met his family, and he and I never met. We'll talk about that in a minute, because that was an interesting choice on his part. But he was clean for 2 years while he wrote this book. And then he said to his wife at the end of the penultimate year of his life, he said, on January the 1st, I'm going to start drinking again. And his marriage disintegrated very, very quickly after that, and he went downhill very quickly after that. And he actually, you know, he shot himself. He didn't literally drink himself to death, but I think he was pretty close to that stage, and he certainly was behaving pretty much as the character in the film was behaving.
Describe some of that behavior for our listeners who haven't seen the film.
Well, it's this unapologetic, excessive drinking. There's a kind of parallel to another book that I was always interested in adapting. I mean, I'm a musician, and I always thought of myself, I always wanted to be a jazz musician, so I have a certain affinity with certain jazz musicians' lives. And one of my favorite musicians, Art Pepper, who was a white West Coast alto saxophonist, wrote a book called Straight Life. And he was a mainline heroin addict and died. But in his book, he talks in very much the same way as the John O'Brien's character talks, with a kind of real candor and an honesty about the fact that if you're an alcoholic, that's what you are. It's like you discover that about yourself, and you can fight it or you can go with it. And, you know, it's a gray area to talk about the morality or the ethics of what is politically or whatever correct. But in Pepper's book, he sort of, there's a description where he, when he has heroin and he looks in the mirror and he says, you know, I liked myself for the first time in my life. I knew who I was for the first time in my life. I mean, don't misunderstand me. This is not, by any stretch of the imagination, me saying this is a good idea to do that. But one of the things that's interesting about the 20th century and literature and drug addiction and alcoholism and so on, there is correctly a politically correct movement that says, this is a bad thing to do. This is bad for people. They shouldn't do this to their bodies. They shouldn't kill themselves in this way. And often that's such a blanket movement that it takes out, you know, some interesting elements of the psychology of why people do these things. And it was one of the elements in O'Brien's thing, that kind of honesty about talking about who he was. And to go back to your question of how he behaved, well, he just drank a lot of alcohol. But not in a way that we're used to sort of seeing. I mean, his behavior wasn't gross. I mean, I've seen a lot of alcoholics and heavy drinkers who behave very badly, who are abusive, who are violent physically, who are violent verbally and so on, have no dignity and behave outrageously. And the O'Brien character, and from my impression of people who met John O'Brien, was that he wasn't at all like that.
You said you never met John O'Brien, the novelist.
No.
How come? I mean, he knew you were going to adapt his novel into a film.
Well, the story was that Stuart Reagan, who runs a gallery in Santa Monica, had picked up the book, I think in a secondhand bookstore, really liked it, and then made contact with John, and then paid out of his own pocket for a first year option on the film rights, and then brought the book to me, and we had our conversations in holding the budget down, and that whole conversation about, you know, let's not unnecessarily spend money. We made inquiries about writers and their availability. A, they were expensive, and B, you know, there's every writer seemed to have three or four scripts in line, and, you know, it meant a lot of time was going to have to go by. So I said, look, I think I understand how to make this film. Let me just do the script. At this point, I'm free, so we don't have. It's not a budget thing. And so that was relayed to John O'Brien, who said that he knew my work, he liked my work, he had no problem with me doing the script, and nor did he have any desire himself to do the script. So I thought it was very cool. He just said, you know, let's keep out of each other's face, and Mike can get on with this. And why don't we meet later on? So we communicated via Stuart Reagan. I did three drafts of the script, and then we got the money, and we were sort of in pre-production, and he killed himself at a point where I was just about in the right place to meet him, and that was my next move. And he'd come into my attorney's office and signed the forms to, you know, give us the rights to the film and everything. I mean, I just would like to stress, because it's something that comes up in a lot of interviews, that the coincidence of we were 2 weeks into prep and he killed himself, it sometimes reads dramatically like there was somehow a connection between those two events. I don't think for a moment it had anything to do with the film or that. I don't want to make that a tragic, sort of romantic, tragic sort of story. It just wasn't. I think he had his agenda. And I think, I'm sure in his own mind by that point in his life, the film represented a very a low significance, you know.
You know, nevertheless, though, just as you'd think in a novel that the person who was contemplating suicide but found love would feel redeemed by love and that suddenly life was worth living,
sure,
one would think that there'd be the possibility that although he was hell-bent on taking his life, that to have a potential success might have made him reconsider. But it didn't.
No. But I also think it throws into relief something that I think is worth talking about, which is that, you know, he took his life. I mean, at the end of the day, at the end of his life, he went out and bought a gun and tidied his apartment. He tried to make a will. I mean, I discovered a really bizarre story that Nick Cage's attorney's partner had met him a couple of times, didn't know who he was, had a drink with him in a bar somewhere in Beverly Hills, and on a Friday night met him, didn't know who he was. I mean, was a very interesting guy, had very good conversations with him. And this man said to him, if I remember correctly, you're an attorney, right? And he said, yeah. And he said, do you do wills? And he said, yeah. He said, well, I'd like you to do mine. And he said, no problem, come in on Monday. And he said, well, could we do it tomorrow, this being a Friday? He said, I don't work on Saturdays. He said, but could you work on a Saturday? And he said, wills always take longer than people think. Come in on Monday. And they left it at that. And he killed himself on the Sunday. So he clearly had worked out, you know, his sort of schedule there. People think of that as, you know, he wanted to kill himself. Maybe it's more that he, as an alcoholic, or as often with junkies and people like that, they know that what they're doing ultimately will kill themselves. And they know that the path they're on is something that is going to limit their life. And they make a choice. I guess maybe it's a fine line we're talking about here, but it's not like I'm so depressed that I have to end my life. It's more that the agenda is different from other people.
Do you know whether he was just a very depressed kind of person, or whether there was a specific crisis that precipitated the suicide?
No, I don't know. And I think his family don't know. And that's, in a way, the tragedy, because they said that he was a very cheerful, witty, up kind of person. Very, very clever, very sharp with words, very, very quick off the mark.
Just like the character in the movie, just like the way Cage plays it.
Well, about 4 days ago, when I was still in England, I got a letter from... first I got a letter from his sister, then I got a letter from his father. They'd all seen the film, and they live in Ohio, and I think there'd been a big feature in the local newspaper, in the sort of calendar section. A very, very charming letter, you know, about how moved they were by the film. And I know from just the day they spent on the film set that one of the things that had really sort of knocked them back was that Nick Cage bore this very strong physical resemblance to their son, and that hearing the way he delivered the lines, and of course the speech patterns were purely those of their son, and that was, you know, a very strange experience for them.
My guest is Mike Figgis. He directed the new film Leaving Las Vegas. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mike Figgis. He directed the new film Leaving Las Vegas and wrote the screenplay based on a novel by John O'Brien, who committed suicide while the film was in pre-production. So when John O'Brien took his life, what impact did it have on you? You were just starting to actually make his movie, make his book into a movie.
Mm. Well, it was in conjunction with another event, which was my first real visit to Las Vegas. You know, I'd been dealing with Las Vegas as a sort of an image, a combination of images from films and literature and so on, and the book, obviously more than anything else, the book. And I went there and was profoundly shocked by the place. I mean, there was nothing of what I expected. And there was a complete absence of romance, and there was an absence of compassion. And the things that I had built up in my mind in the book and in the story as being necessary for the redemption of the character. And I realized at that point what a devastating story this was, because to make a choice to actually go and die in that town, that being the place where you will die, I mean, that is something else. It made it 10 times tougher than I'd allowed it to be up until that point. So I was still kind of dealing and reeling back from that experience with the reality of, well, how I saw the reality of Las Vegas in relation to the story. And then, you know, almost casually, I got the news that John O'Brien had killed himself. And these two events together really stopped me in my tracks. I mean, we'd got the money, I'd cast the film. The Las Vegas experience had also told me another thing, that how tough to make this film was going to be, that how much energy one would have to pump into it every single day in order to keep the energy high for the crew and everything like that. And I've just about come to terms with that and was able to deal with that. And in fact, I'd literally physically gone into training and gone to a gym and realized that I was going to need more energy than I normally had. And then the second piece of information, John's death, it really stopped me. And I also sort of morally kind of thought, well, I wonder if one has the moral right to continue with the story in a way. It's because it's now not just a piece of fiction. It really has come true. And you're dealing with something. And also, I did know that afterwards, that if we did go ahead and make the film, that it would be a factor, that would be, like we're discussing it now. It would have the danger of turning into myth. The resistance of over-romanticizing the story. And I didn't want his death to become a kind of, as it were, a romantic element that could be used as a kind of publicity element as well, if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes perfect sense. But you must have felt like this extraordinary responsibility.
Yes, certainly, yeah.
You know, because if you continued with it, you had a responsibility not just to the text, but to his life and to his death. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, you didn't want to, like, heroicize the whole thing.
Yes. I mean, you're absolutely right. That puts it in a nutshell. I mean, suddenly there was this a burden, actually. Because normally as a filmmaker, you know, you have this indulgent license to really do whatever you want. Whilst you're making the film, and then, you know, depending on the size of the budget, you know, you can get into various fights with other people, committees on who work for studios or whatever. But on this one, I knew that one of the reasons I wanted to do it was to have as much freedom as possible, and not, you know, I had Final Cut, which you know, is almost unheard of in American filmmaking, and it's almost like I suddenly didn't have Final Cut. You know, I had this. I always wanted to make it in the best way possible and to be true to the story. But now I really had to be true to the story. And I didn't even know the story in the sense that I hadn't met John. You know, I had this novel to go on, not a very long novel. And I'd already kind of mapped out a very, very strong version of the novel, which is personal. I mean, it was Mike Figgis at that point, not John O'Brien. And I hadn't even met John O'Brien. I mean, part of my plan was, you know, to get to the point of having the confidence in my own writing. And to be honest, I was in awe of his writing. I mean, normally speaking, I don't have a problem dealing with scripts or rewriting scripts, because script writing is not the same as the writing of a novel. It's suddenly like, if you were doing an adaptation of a Steinbeck novel and he was still alive, you'd be fairly nervous about meeting the man and then saying, what do you think of the script, i.e. the cartoon version of your great piece of work. And so I got just to the point where my ego was strong enough to say, well, I could now sit down with John O'Brien and take some criticism from him about, and I was expecting that. I thought he would say, okay, well, that's pretty good, but I don't think, you haven't got this right at all. You know, that's not the way I saw this. And I was quite prepared to have that conversation and say, okay, well, tell me how I can, tell me what to do here. How can I switch this round or adapt this to make this closer to how you see it?
Now you wouldn't have a self anymore.
No, I wouldn't. I mean, in a way, so I was free. But on the other hand, you know, it was freedom I didn't particularly want.
Right. So when John O'Brien killed himself, how did it change your idea of how you should handle the story?
It reduced the arbitrary element at a stroke. It's like, you know, you really have to be on the ball. You cannot just sort of, as it were, go in and improvise on this. You've got to know, you've really got to have a very, very, very clear overview of what you're doing. Because I'd also, you know, I'd created this framework for making the film, which is, you know, we were going to shoot the film in 28 days, which we did, and the budget had crept up to 3.5 million, but, you know, I knew I didn't have any more money than that. So I'd created such limitations, which I thought, you know, and proved to be also, you know, artistically challenging and the right thing to do. But I hadn't really cut myself any leeway here. And now, and it's almost like you've got to have your 3 days of mourning for the guy and for the tragedy and suddenly, and the realization of what you are doing is now, whilst it's not drama documentary, it's a hell of a lot more real than just a fictional novel. And then you've basically got to pick yourself up by your bootstraps and get your strength and now carry on and lead everybody and get the film through. And obviously, I mean, things like the film becomes 10 times more poignant when you're shooting it. You know, certain lines, which were just lines before.
Like what?
Well, you know, when he's lying with Elizabeth Shue, with the Sarah character, after they first meet at the motel, and she says, "So what brings you to, you know, what brings you to Las Vegas? Convention?" And Nick just smiles and says, "No, I came here to drink myself to death." And she laughs and looks a little puzzled and says, "How long is that going to take you, you know?" He says, "Well, I've got whatever it is, you know, $300 a day. I think about 4 weeks, more or less. I'm not sure, but about 4 weeks." And all those lines become, you know, real, very real. And sometimes very difficult to deal with, you know, because you're also dealing with an actor like Nick Cage, who is, well, not to put too fine a point in it, I think, in my opinion, one maybe the best actor in America. You know, I'd always admired the guy and thought he was very, very good, but when I saw him deal with this stuff, he was pulling things out that brought it to life in a very spectacular way. And the lines seem very meaningful.
Mike Figgis directed the new film Leaving Las Vegas. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Mike Figgis, director of the new film Leaving Las Vegas, starring Nicolas Cage and Elizabeth Shue. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new R&B recordings by the singer D'Angelo and rapper R. Kelly.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Mike Figgis, director of the new film Leaving Las Vegas. Figgis adapted the screenplay from a semi-autobiographical novel by John O'Brien, who committed suicide while the film was in the pre-production stage. Leaving Las Vegas stars Nicolas Cage as an alcoholic who goes to Vegas to drink himself to death. He meets a prostitute there, played by Elizabeth Shue. They fall in love, but he won't let that interrupt his plan. In this scene, she's asked him to move in with her. He tells her she must be crazy.
You haven't seen the worst of it. These last few days, I've been very controlled. But I knock things over and throw up all the time. I mean, right now, I feel really good. You're like some kind of antidote, mixes with the liquor and keeps me in balance. But that won't last forever.
Okay. Don't you like me, Ben?
Sarah, what you don't understand is... No, see, no.
What?
You can never, never ask me to stop drinking. Do you understand?
I do. I really do.
Well, what kind of talks did you have about Nicolas Cage, who I think is really quite extraordinary in the role, about how to play the character? You know, how to play him without pity, but also without false gusto?
Well, I mean, one of the things about casting Nick Cage was that from the first phone calls with him, when he said, yeah, I love the script, I'd like to do it, you know, when he said why he liked the script, it became clear that he understood. So it's the best kind of situation for a director and an actor to have, where, you know, from the very beginning of the project, I knew that he was completely in sync with the way John O'Brien had written it and the way I'd adapted it. And we never really actually had to have those conversations because it was a given that he understood. And he never, ever did anything, either in the rehearsal period or during the filming, to knock me off my understanding that he was on track. So they were really just conversations, the best kind of conversations you can ever have, like whether they're with musicians or actors or collaborators, just about nuance and choice.
Now, you said before that at about the time you found out about John O'Brien's suicide, you had also gone to Las Vegas and realized that it wasn't what you'd expected. What had you expected it to be, and how was it different?
I'd expected a kind of tough, you know, sexually dynamic, interestingly decadent. And of course, when I got there and tried to sort of picture those things compared to what I was now seeing, I couldn't actually come up with a picture in the same way that when you pitch a story, you're pitching the heart of a story, but none of the exterior details are actually in place yet. If someone said, well, describe the left hand of that story, well, you go, well, is it a short hand? Are there long artistic fingers? You say, well, I actually haven't thought about those details yet. I just feel that it should be like this. And so my feeling about Vegas was very much based on that kind of literature of another era altogether, I think. I thought people would be better looking. I mean, that's a stupid thing to say.
Let me describe a shot in Leaving Las Vegas that I have a feeling sums up what you're saying. It's a I forget whether the camera's panning or whether it's montage, but you see the kind of neon marquees of several casinos, and in the middle of it you see the bright lights of the McDonald's sign, and it just kind of cheapens everything that you're seeing. It puts everything on the level of fast food, not mm-hmm. glamorous casino.
Yeah, well, you know, the way you shoot any film, whether it's high or low budget, is that you get there and you look through a camera and what are the images that are going to fill the screen in the most interesting way? I mean, as it happens, the McDonald's, they'd used a lot of neon. In a way, it's quite beautiful. I mean, you recognize it as a McDonald's sign, but it's very much a Vegas McDonald's sign. But yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, it is reduced to that. It's reduced to a kind of Disney-esque, generic sign kind of place, like pretty much like anywhere else. And that when you go into the casinos, the lighting... I mean, I just saw a casino, and it's beautifully lit, and much better lit. Although one could argue that he's filming a different era, and therefore he has the license to suggest, and who's going to argue that the casinos were better lit in the 70s? I personally doubt that they were. The lighting's really dreadful in all of those places, and people don't look very good in the lighting. I mean, the interior lighting of the huge casino halls. There are no windows. There's no soft light. It's very unflattering light everywhere. And people look older than they are, and they look iller than they are. And the accumulative effect is very depressing. Once I actually shot there, and I'd spent some time there, I began to get used to it, and it was no longer a shock when I walked into those spaces, because I knew what I was in for. But the first time, I was really profoundly shocked.
Was making Leaving Las Vegas a depressing experience for you?
No. I mean, paradoxically, it was the happiest experience I've ever had in my life on a film set. Best crew I've ever had. The best actors. I mean, as in terms of, you know, fitting in with the ensemble. Normally, you know, filmmaking is... There are things about the film that you love, and there are always things about the film that you don't love. And it's a sort of... It's like a competition, and you hope that the things that you love will be ahead by a couple of points at the end of the experience. This wasn't like that at all. I mean, probably also helped by the fact that it was so quick and so intense, and that the drama was so strong in it, and it sort of affected everybody. But very, very cheerful experience. I mean, I guess it would have to be if everybody was depressed on the film, as well as the subject matter being dark. I think it might have been unbearable to do. But very, very high energy.
I want to say something about Elizabeth Shue's performance. She plays the prostitute who falls in love with the Nicolas Cage character. And I think it's a terrific performance, and I was very excited to see it because I think American movies offer so little opportunities now for good actresses. And it's always possible for a prostitute type of role to lead to a very stereotyped kind of performance. And I think she brings a depth to the performance and intelligence. You always imagine that she has a very interesting inner life. Whether mm-hmm. she's educated or not, she brings a depth to the performance that makes the character very complicated and an interesting, equal to the Nicolas Cage character, an interesting counterpart to mm-hmm. the character. They worked really well together.
When I read the book, one of the things that I really liked about it was that it was written from two points of view. He was in the head of Ben and he was in the head of Sarah. And they were about 50-50 in terms of lines on the page by the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I was as interested in her character as I was in his when reading the book. And one of the reasons I wanted to make it as a film was because I'm always desperately searching for good female parts. I mean, I'm a man. I'm interested in women. Probably more than I'm interested in men, because I probably know more about men. Therefore, they're not as interesting to me. And I know a lot of filmmakers, well, certainly European filmmakers, would share that, you know. And looking at American drama and the scripts that, you know, do the rounds, you know, there's a complete and utter absence of any intelligent or in-depth writing about female characters. And I think that's one of the reasons, probably... as much as anything else, was why I wanted to do this, because I thought, you know, at last, here is a story that has two characters. It's a love story. It's between a man and a woman, and the female character is as important as the male character. She doesn't just come along and support him. And she has a voice, and she has... Her psychology is as complex as his and just as interesting.
Exactly. I mean, you have to be able to watch this film and be able to give some kind of answer to the question, what do you see as her motivation for staying in love with him and being so dedicated when she knows that for the rest of his life he's going to be throwing up, knocking things over, forgetting everything in a drunken stupor, and nothing's going to stop him from continuing.
Mm-hmm.
And she brings the kind of quality to the role where you can project onto her, or, you know, imagine all these reasons that she'd have for doing it, you know, reasons that are in the script and reasons that aren't even necessarily expressed in the script.
Mm-hmm. But there are lines in the script. I mean, one of the things that's brilliant about the script, which in turn is merely a workmanlike adaptation of what was brilliant about the novel. And it's not false modesty. I mean, you know, it's all in the book. But there are lines like, you know, very short lines. People say, oh, we need more, you know, always would say, oh, we've got to have backstory. Why is she a prostitute? And the reason why they need to know why she's a prostitute is because, you know, they can't deal with the fact that she's a prostitute or somebody's a bank robber, you know. And I always say, well, you know what, he's a bank robber because he's a bank robber. She's a prostitute because she's a prostitute. I mean, why is that such a profoundly shocking thing that she's a prostitute, given the number of prostitutes that exist in America, England, Scotland, France, Germany, any country in the world? You know, this is not a unique occupation. It just appears to be a fact of life in any culture. Therefore, surely by the millennium, we're intellectually in a strong enough position to just say, you know what, those functions exist. We don't always have to know exactly why they've got to. It's not an issue.
My guest is Mike Figgis. He directed the new film Leaving Las Vegas, starring Nicolas Cage as an alcoholic who goes to Vegas to drink himself to death. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mike Figgis, and he directed and wrote the screenplay for the new movie Leaving Las Vegas. In Leaving Las Vegas, Nicolas Cage plays an alcoholic who's drinking himself to death. Now, I read that your parents were alcoholics. Is that something you could talk about, or
sure?
What kind of drinkers were they?
Well, I just got a letter from my sister, who actually lives in San Diego. So, if you're listening, Dinah, this is an answer to your letter. Who was really horrified that I said that. And she said, well, I know they like to drink, but I think that's going a bit far. And I think, you know, all interviews are precis of conversations. And I think the conversation was along the lines that one of the things that shocked me when I first came to America was the definition of alcoholism. You know, I suddenly realized that a large number of my friends were alcoholic, because I think the European definition is perhaps has more tolerance built into it for heavy drinking before people would ever acknowledge that it was, you know, the real thing. However, I do think that I have a certain sympathy with the American definition. And my parents were heavy drinkers. You know, my father was a pilot in the Second World War, was flying when he was 18 years old. Told me afterwards, when I was always trying to kind of romanticize his role as a pilot in the war, and, you know, how many planes did you shoot down, and tell me some stories. And one day, he got very angry with me. He said, no, I have to tell you that the whole experience was, you know, just a ghastly nightmare from beginning to end, and that I had to drink, you know, a quarter of a bottle of scotch sometimes to get into a plane and take off because I was so frightened. You know, he was 18 years old, and then he was brought up in Africa, sort of British colonial family. We were all raised in Nairobi in Kenya. It was a heavy drinking town. I mean, my memory of it is rather like, you know, the beginning of The Secret Garden. I can remember parties with people passed out, people falling out of windows, stories of husbands who'd accidentally shot their wives because everybody was armed to the teeth because of the Mau Mau and everybody was paranoid. People just drank like there was no tomorrow. And they drank spirits, they didn't drink wine or beer. And my memory of that period is, and we're talking about the mid to late 50s, you know, early 50s, the mid 50s, was of a lot of adults drunk a lot of the time.
What was most confusing to you as a child, watching your parents be drunk a lot of the time?
Well, what's the most confusing to any child is the instability, the emotional instability, the idea that the temperature of the room can change from comfortably warm to very, very cold in about 10 seconds. And as a child, you don't quite understand why, but, you know, it's got something to do with alcohol. Something that was, you know, a huge influence for me when I was making this film was Albert Finney's performance in Under the Volcano. And there's a scene in that where he's sitting with his ex-wife or his wife and the guy who has been her lover also. And they've been to a bullfight, I think. And things are going really well. And Albert Finney's being very jovial. And then suddenly, just on a dime, he turns and he just lays into both of them. And it was a moment that I recognized, not just in my parents, but in other people. And that alcoholic effect, I think, for a child is devastating. So when I, you know, in that interview, it was in the New York Times, when I said that that in, you know, in a way that they were alcoholic. I mean, you know, when we got back to England and then later on when I was growing up, they drank very heavily at weekends and stuff like that would happen, but they didn't drink in the week. But, you know, my understanding is that still puts you into the definition of having an alcoholic or a substance problem, even though you can deal with it on a day-to-day, you know, like Monday to Friday I don't do it, or Monday to Thursday, but Friday night to Sunday I do it.
Did your parents' drinking give you any insights into leaving Las Vegas?
Yeah, it gives me actually, funnily enough, it's the opposite effect. It gives you a huge compassion for them. And I think what it is that it's that psychological thing of wanting to heal people who are like that, and that by dealing with the story and making the character and having compassion for the characters, in a way, it's a way of touching the characters, in a way of touching that sort of state and that situation. I mean, I still have an abhorrence of it myself. And there's also another funny thing with alcohol, which is that, I mean, I have a problem with alcohol in that I can't get drunk. If I carry on drinking, I will eventually pass out, but I never, ever can lose control, which I'm sure is a hangover from the desire always to be in control when alcohol is involved, because of the way I've seen other people lose control, which I don't like. So I cling on. I cling on to sort of... Whereas other people would embrace the lack of controls, and that would be why... I mean, I know people, I'm sure if you gave them a placebo alcohol within a glass of whatever they thought was scotch, they'd be out of control and smashing up a bar, you know? So those weird sort of definitions, I think, are really interesting with alcohol. And I'm very interested in not just, you know, alcoholics, but also junkies and all kinds of people who drift into that area. I'm fascinated by them.
Has it been hard for you to find your place in the film world? I know you've had at least one experience in Hollywood that you weren't very happy with, because you lost the cut of the movie and it didn't turn out the way you wanted, and so on. Leaving Las Vegas, I think, is doing pretty well, and it's certainly a critical success. Do you want to be invited back, so to speak? I mean, do you want to get back into that world of larger budgets but less control?
What I want to be is a filmmaker. This is what I always wanted to be, whether it's a musician or a filmmaker or whatever, is someone who can capitalize on the big plus of the job, which is... You're peripatetic. You can go wherever you want. I have no huge beef with Hollywood as a, you know, the big bad wolf. I think that they are what they are. And as I said earlier, it's built on the idea that it's a business and you make money. And I think I was naive on the film Mr. Jones, where I was, you know, bitterly disappointed. I felt humiliated. I felt that I was beaten up unnecessarily by certain people. But I also was naive. Because I was still kind of, you know, saying I'm a European, I'm an artist, and so on. And looking back on it, you know, I could have made life easier for myself either by behaving on their terms or getting out earlier, you know, because in fact the writing was not only on the wall, it was printed, you know, it wasn't in chalk. That's all. And I mean, in terms of the interesting scripts and interesting material, I think they're always going to come on the sort of low-budget, slightly offbeat kind of source. I don't think the nature of the beast of Hollywood is that those scripts and those ideas are not going to filter through the big studio system, because by the time they get to the director, they have been through so many committee stages that which may have been interesting about them in the first place will probably have been smoothed out. And that's fine. So one has to sort of know to look elsewhere.
Mike Figgis, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure, Terry.
Mike Figgis directed the new film Leaving Las Vegas, starring Nicolas Cage. This is Fresh Air. After a period in which rhythm and blues ballads took a back seat to tough-talking rap music, R&B is back with a harder edge. A newcomer called D'Angelo has a hit with his debut album, Brown Sugar. And rapper R. Kelly is vocalizing more melodically on his new self-titled release. Ken Tucker has reviews of these two new collections.
Let me tell you about this girl, maybe I should. I met her in Philly and her name was Brown Sugar. See, we be making love constantly. That's why my eyes are a shade blood burgundy. The way that we kiss is unlike any other way that I be kissing. When I'm kissing, what I'm missing, won't you listen? Brown sugar, babe.
The soft purr in D'Angelo's voice gives his game away. He's a young version of an old R&B smoothie, buttering up his baby and his listeners with an elegant line of patter and a strong croon. On his first album, D'Angelo makes a break with current male African-American pop music that insists upon cold, hard realism. Instead, D'Angelo harks back to a time when R&B singers proved their strength by describing their sensitivity. Smokey Robinson is old enough to be D'Angelo's father, and he's one of the younger singer's primary influences. D'Angelo pays homage to Robinson's muscular romanticism with this cover of Smokey's Cruisin'.
Baby, let's cruise. From here, don't be confused, baby. The way is clear, and if you want it, you get it forever. Oh, just got a one last day.
Where D'Angelo is launching his career with creamy ballads, R. Kelly is using them to mark a shift in his. A year ago, Kelly had sold millions of copies of his album 12 Play by rapping tunes such as Bump and Grind and Freak That Body. Now he's put out an album that's nearly wall-to-wall ballads, and a typical song title is this one, Religious Love.
Slowly the rain is falling.
It turns out that R. Kelly, far from being just another hip-hop devotee, has been heavily influenced by some of the more delicate soul styles of the 70s, Philadelphia International producers Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, middle period Stevie Wonder, and the overreaching funk emotionalism of Donnie Hathaway. The result is a series of slow, sensuous grooves.
Wondering how did things go wrong? Every night asking myself what happened to our happy home. Will I ever see you again? I need to know, my friend.
Now the past is gone.
Past is gone.
But tomorrow's on.
But tomorrow,
girl, the sun is going down.
I need you around. I'm willing to trade in my life.
Trade in my life for.
Neither D'Angelo nor R. Kelly has renounced the influence of rap music. They use it to give vehemence to their proclamations of love. And more broadly speaking, they deploy rap's insistence upon sharp detail and narrative forthrightness to cut through the sentimentalism of romantic music. This new sort of realistic R&B bodes well for the future of these men, and for any number of singers who admire the past, yet want to create a different future.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the debut album by D'Angelo and R. Kelly's new self-titled album. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, Al Banks, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Sipora Lubar. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Don't think I'm seeing them looking at you. All of them wishing they could have you. And as a matter of fact, a bunch of them itching for you to scratch them. I'm trying to hide the one with me. I'm trying to come with the rain. And I'm on begging no, 'cause I want them to know I'm my lady. You're my lady.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Crown, publisher of Ken Follett's new novel, A Place Called Freedom. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.